KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, Michael Shermer is joining us. He's the editor of Skeptic Magazine, probably the country's best-known skeptic, a proponent of reason over superstition and religion. In his latest book, he examines why it is so many of us believe in an afterlife. The book is about when humans first became aware of death and what effect that's had on the way we live our lives and think about what happens when we die. The book is Heavens on Earth. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Julia Ritchie from KUER's State Politics Podcast, 45 Days. Every Friday, I get together with my fellow reporter, Nicole Nixon, to break down the latest news and bills from the Utah legislative session. If you live in Utah, this stuff will affect you. So subscribe on your favorite podcast app and sign up for our newsletter at 45days.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's a question Michael Shermer asks in his book. At what point did it occur to the earliest human beings that they were going to die, that death is inevitable? It's hard to pin down, of course, as Shermer points out. Thoughts don't fossilize, but there are some clues, like when they first started burying their dead. Maybe that means something, that they mourned or grieved, and that made them think about their own condition. Shermer, of course, is a skeptic, so he also takes into account the possibility they were just burying their dead for sanitary reasons, because it's really difficult to guess if, as he puts it, our ancient ancestors had some inchoate conception of an afterlife. But we do know that it was only a matter of time, as he says, that people began to compose stories and myths about the afterlife. Michael Shermer explores what effect this has had on the way we live our lives and think about what happens when we die. It's a scientific exploration. His book is called Heavens on Earth, and today in the program, he's joining us to talk about it. Shermer is the publisher of Skeptic Magazine, a monthly columnist for Scientific American. He's joining us from the studios of UC Santa Barbara today. And Michael Shermer, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
I guess I want to begin with what got you thinking about this. I know this has been something on your mind for a while. When did you first think, I'm going to write a book about this and start of, and what were you thinking it would be about, like the thing that you really wanted to understand?
Well, I guess it's because I reached my 60s, so you might say I'm cramming for the final. I mean, one does start to think about these things maybe a little bit more. I'm a pretty optimistic, cheery person. So, you know, death isn't something I've given a lot of thought to, but I've written books about science and pseudoscience, science and religion, science and God, science and morality. So this was kind of the next natural step on, you know, the big existential questions. And so I thought I would tackle it. From a scientist's perspective. Now, you know, there's tons of books from religious perspectives on the afterlife and heaven and so on from those who are quite confident that it's real. What I wanted to know is, you know, what can scientists from different areas tell us about these different aspects of the afterlife? And what do we know? What do we not know? And, you know, what about near-death experiences and reincarnation and you know, which version of heaven is the correct one? If you're a scientist, they're all different. Yeah. You know, what do we take away from that? So, you know, I kind of started researching and writing and putting that all together. And then I threw in the segments on utopias because, in fact, people do try to construct heavens on earth, literally, you know, a perfect society. And those have not borne out well in terms of their success.
Yeah. How common is this, a belief in an afterlife?
Well, you read the stats at the top of the hour that, you know, it's about 3/4 of Americans, which varies by religion. Mormons the highest, Jews less than half, Mormons about 95%, and, you know, Protestants, Baptists, and so on in between there. And then I found that weird statistic about, you know, from a huge database sample of atheists, self-proclaimed atheist agnostics, about a third of them said they believe in the continuation of consciousness after death. Now, that's not necessarily believing in a heaven, like a Christian heaven, but somehow you know, that your consciousness continues after the death of the brain and body. Now, the survey didn't ask what they were thinking, but I have a pretty good sense of what they're thinking because I know a lot of these people. This is my community. I'm an atheist. And I think they're turning toward things like Deepak Chopra's sort of Western version of Buddhism, mm-hmm. you know, that consciousness is primary in the universe and you just return to that big consciousness in the sky, so to speak, the force that's out there. Some people call it quantum consciousness, like from these quantum physics experiments where you get this kind of spooky action at a distance, as if there's kind of a quantum field that infuses the entire cosmos. Maybe our consciousness continues on there in the quantum field. Something like that, I think, is what they're looking for.
But is it motivated by the same thing that Christians, the same reason, you know, that they just – they're kind of in denial about the reality?
I don't think it's a denial. No, I think we all can see that death is real. The problem is that you can't imagine being dead. That is, you can't imagine not being conscious and alive because that's what it means to imagine something. You can't imagine death because to imagine something, you have to be alive. So that sets up something of a paradox. We can see death is real. It's happened to the 100 billion people that have lived before us, and no one's come back for sure that we're confident about. So, and yet I can't picture myself not being conscious and alive. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can imagine falling asleep, but I have dreams, and I've personally undergone general anesthesia twice, and I, you know, I kind of know what that's like, but not really. It's mm-hmm. just, you know, 10, 9, 8, boom, boom, lights out.
Yeah.
And then I wake up, and I have no idea how much time has elapsed because when the brain is unconscious under general anesthesia, there's no time lapse. There's nothing keeping track up there. So I imagine death as something like that, except you just never wake up. Now, maybe you wake up. I mean, this is – I want to say from the beginning, I don't know for sure there's no afterlife. I would be quite surprised. But you never know. We don't know everything. And you know, it's possible that something like this, you just wake up in some other dimension or something like that. I doubt it, but I wouldn't be – I wouldn't object to it if it was the kind of place that – you know, was interesting, stimulating. My friends and family were there. You know, I've lost all my parents and I have four parents, step parents. They're all gone. And my friends, Carl Sagan and Stephen Jay Gould and Christopher Hitchens, you know, they've passed. And I would personally like to see them again. And if that's the case, okay. But I think that there's no evidence for that, not sufficient evidence to be confident of that desire.
You mentioned that leaves us with this paradox, this mortality paradox. I wanted to ask you a little bit about it. The British philosopher Stephen Cave, you mentioned in the book, he talks about this paradox. And he says that our not being able to imagine our non-existence has led to these narratives that we've created. He goes through four of them. Let's talk a little bit about these, if you would, because I think this is kind of where we've landed, it seems.
Yeah, I think I like Steve Cave's narrative structure as a way of just sort of talking about these things, you know, that we want to live on through our work, for example. Mm-hmm. We're going to be productive, creative individuals with the time we have. I think that's my favorite of the narratives. But, you know, that's the one like the Woody Allen quip, you know, I don't want to live on in my work. I want to live on in my apartment. you know, that's unsatisfying for most people. That they don't consider that a form of immortality because your point of view self, the you looking through your eyes out at the world, is not involved in that. It's just you're gone and your work continues. And or through your children, you know, that's a kind of form of immortality that, in fact, evolution gave us. Yeah. That is, you know, why do we have to die? I deal with that. We can talk about that later. But, you know, that in a way, you're not necessary after a couple of generations. And so your genes continue. So our genes are immortal. The species is immortal as long as it doesn't go extinct, even though the individuals fail. But what he's after is more of the much more common ones, the narrative that somehow a soul continues. And part of the reason for that is we have this sort of a natural-born dualism. That is, we feel like there's thoughts floating around in our head separate from our brain operating because you can't feel your brain operating. You have no sense of the neurons firing or anything. But I can sense that I have thoughts and I can sense that they're floating around in my head. So it feels like they're separate from the physical material. So there's a non-physical material, a non-corporeal element to our existence. And this is called dualism. And ever since Descartes first kind of articulated this in the Western world, most people identify with dualism. That is, they feel like there's a body and a soul, a mm-hmm. brain and a mind, and a corporeal and incorporeal, and that there's something else to the universe that's not material, and it continues on. And again, I think that's where these atheist agnostics project themselves going into some sort of quantum field that isn't physical. So, so that's the most common narrative I think people have come up with. Different versions of that, but that's where somehow you continue on.
I want to ask about this idea that early human groups developed, a belief in the afterlife and religious rituals connected to that as a way of looking at death as a terror. And those who developed these rituals to deal with it, that conceived of this idea of an afterlife, were more likely to actually survive. That is, that I guess natural selection selected for people who were inclined to believe in an afterlife.
Talk about maybe, right?
You're skeptical, of course, but I am. But talk about that if you would.
Yeah. So this is early on. If you start researching the subject of death and so forth, you encounter in psychological realms this terror management theory.
Yeah.
And this has been around for about a quarter century. And it's this idea that the awareness of our mortality and that we're going to die is anxiety producing. It produces this form of terror inside your brain. And so you do things to overcome the terror, like be productive and creative. And so terror management theory people believe that, you know, most of civilization, period, just the construction of large monumental architecture and art, music, literature, poetry, even science and so on, any of the creative arts, is a product of this terror, pushing back, dealing with the anxiety produced by awareness of your death.
We had to keep our minds occupied because we were so terrified of death that we created great buildings.
I don't buy it. Right. Now, first of all, I instinctively don't feel that way. I don't know anybody that obsesses about death and walks around in a state of terror. And of course, they admit that. I know, but it's subconscious. It's inside you, and you just don't know it. It's like, okay, if it's subconscious, how do we know that it's there? Well, we trick the brain through these priming experiments where we have subjects think about their death or contemplate their death and then have them do some task. And the outcome of the task is different than compared to subjects that aren't primed with thinking about their death. Okay, maybe. But I suspect strongly that it's tapping something else when you're priming them to think about death. They're tapping it. They're not measuring what they think they're measuring. And so I spent quite a bit of time on that. I did a study, a bizarre study. I ran across this weird data set that the state of Texas Department of Justice has recorded every final statement made by a death row inmate the moment before he's executed.
Yeah.
And going back to 1982, they've executed, I forget the number, 480 something. They've executed more than 500, but 400 and something left a final statement. And you just have to picture what this looks like. These guys are, they're on the gurney, arms spread out like a crucifix, and the needles are in their arms. The microphone comes down. Would you like to say anything? And the warden is there, the family of the person who was murdered is there, and so on. It's like, wow, okay. Now, if you want to know what somebody thinks about at the moment they're going to die, this is the perfect scenario.
Yeah.
And so I coded them. I read them all through and just started kind of looking at what are the themes that come up. And it was like most of them were positive emotions, primarily love, but forgiveness, asking for forgiveness, particularly love for their family, wife, sister, girlfriend.
Yeah, they weren't motivated by fear.
No.
It didn't seem. Yeah.
No, not at all. And so I was stunned by this. Like, wow, okay. And another weird one that I noticed was only one of the 400 and something said they loved their father. And so I started looking at the background of these guys. I think most of them didn't have fathers. They were raised in broken homes or orphanages or raised by single moms. And, a lot of them, quite a few of them, said they loved their mom. And I think, this is a proxy for criminal behavior, is being raised without a father in the home. Anyway, so But the point of that study is that really, you know, when you are faced with the most existential thing you can, this is the demise of my being, my essence is going to be gone. What is it that I want to say? I want to say how much I love everybody that I have, you know, encountered and those close to me.
Yeah. Well, Michael, isn't this kind of the theme to the book? This is sort of where you come back around to. That is, I mean, if you look at the percentage of people who these percentages, you know. Those who had an opinion about capital punishment, that there was like 2.8% said something or professed their innocence,
yeah.
14%.
Yeah.
And those who said something about hell, 8%. But those who said something about love, 68%.
Yeah, by far the dominant.
Theme. I mean, that must say something kind of powerful.
I think it does. I think a far more powerful emotion in human existence than terror, fear,
yeah.
is love. Because we're a social primate species. You know, we desperately need contact with other people in our community, our families, our friends, our, you know, our species. That's why solitary confinement is a form of torture. By the UN considers a form of torture. We should not be doing that to anybody. It'd be better to be dead than alone. I mean, it's that bad. And I think that's part of our, you know, development. It's one of the compelling elements of religion. You know, atheists are fond of thinking, well, we don't need religion. But what is it that appeals to people about religion? I think it's the social, mm-hmm. interactive, you know, the hugging and touching in church. You know, just the bonded, the social bondedness. You can get that from many different areas, but religion's kind of tapped into that. I think early on, thousands of years ago, this is part of who we are.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we're seeing in those death row inmate statements.
When did we first, to the degree that we know this, when did we first become aware of our own when do we first become aware of our own mortality? About what age are we kind of keyed into that?
Yeah, developmentally it happens pretty early.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, I cite Paul Bloom's research at Yale in his developmental lab of little children. These are preschoolers,
yeah.
who are shown a little puppet show where a mouse gets munched by an alligator and he's dead. And then they ask the children, you know, questions about the mouse, you know. And these kids think, well, the mouse is – he's still alive. He's somewhere else. And he misses his mommy and he's hungry and he's scared. And, you know, these – preschoolers have this dualistic notion that something survives the death of the body and,
yeah.
goes somewhere else,
yeah.
and still has some emotions,
yeah.
that are kind of carried with it. And so,
which tells you what? That this is naturally intuitive. This
cognitively, yes,
yeah.
our brains are programmed to be naturally dualistic. That is, we just think that there's something else that continues. The essence of a thing, mm-hmm. continues. This is sometimes called essentialism. That mm-hmm. that things contain an essence that defines them, and we tend to animate those essences into agents that are real. Think of the volleyball in the Tom Hanks movie.
Mm-hmm. Wilson.
Wilson.
Yeah,
yeah, the Wilson.
Yeah.
You know, he imbues it with agency, like it's a personal thing that he loves and becomes bonded and attached to. And when it floats away, he's crying, sobbing, really, mm-hmm. just a terrible loss. And that's actually very iconic for the reality of these things. How, you know, we imbue things with agency and essentialism, and that's part of our dualistic nature. Again, you can't imagine being dead, so we just picture our consciousness continuing somehow, somewhere beyond the body. And there, from there, religions start to layer onto it.
Yeah.
But
this seems like this is a really interesting moment here, because you write about how just as soon as children come to understand the reality of death, this is when they're, as you said, they're kind of piled on with these layers from religion or culture, or whatever, that, you know, death is just a transition to another place. And this is something you call deceptive advertising. And it seems like you're saying we're missing a crucial opportunity for young people as soon as they come to this awareness, as opposed to making them feel afraid of it, maybe thinking about it in different ways, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, where's grandma? She's gone. Well, where is she? Well, she's in heaven. Oh, okay. So this programming starts very early.
Yeah.
And, you know, the death of the pet, you know, the dog is in doggy heaven or whatever. You know, it's supposed to make children feel better, you know, there's no research that shows that it does. It's just kind of an instinctive thing we do just to because we think that people don't want to face the idea of death. But I'd like us to rethink all of that, for all of us, not just for children, but just to emphasize the fact that no one knows what happens. And why not just say, I don't know where Grandma is. She's gone. She may be gone forever. We may see her again. We may not see her again. But let's remember her now for what she was to us and what she did and what she meant to us and how much we loved her and how much she loved us and, you know, that kind of thing. Why not emphasize reality that we know for sure, rather than the fantasy of pretending that we know something that we don't know? And, you know, I think children are more robust than we give them credit for. I think they can handle that sort of thing. We live in a Judeo-Christian culture, so it's imbued in practically everything. But the fastest growing religious group in America, as well as the world, are the nuns, the people that have no religious affiliation. Yeah. You know, that's a third of all millennials, and that's going to be half of all millennials within a decade or so. And that means we really need to face the fact that we need a new worldview, an enlightenment humanism worldview that faces reality for what it is, and admits when we don't know something.
It's Michael Shermer. His book is called Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Support for KUER comes from the local and national businesses around the state that underwrite our programming. Shows like Morning Edition, Radio West, and All Things Considered. If your business or organization cares about the in-depth local news and fascinating conversations you can only find on public radio, team up with KUER. To learn more about becoming an underwriter, look for the Support tab at KUER.org and click on Business Support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Michael Shermer is joining us. He's the editor of Skeptic Magazine, probably the country's best-known skeptic, a proponent of reason over superstition and religion. In his latest book, he examines why it is so many of us believe in an afterlife. The book is called Heavens on Earth. He's joining us from the studios at UC Santa Barbara. I should also mention he's a fellow at Chapman University in Orange, California, and a columnist for Scientific American. So what did you learn, Michael Shermer, from looking at animals about how they mourn and what their ideas?
It's an interesting problem. First, when are the first humans to ever realize, oh, my God, we're going to die?
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, we don't know. Thoughts don't fossilize, as you mentioned at the top of the hour. And it could be just the intentional burial of bodies is just to get them under the ground because of what the decay of the flesh is not sanitary for, say, cave living or small community living. So what we need is something like grave goods, and we do have those, possibly as early as 100,000. Years ago, that we had the cognition to think, okay, it's not just that he's dead, but that he's going somewhere else. So we need to put some tools in there and weapons and artifacts that are costly to produce as a way of sort of sending him into his next life, that kind of thing. For sure, by the time of the ancient Egyptians, with the burial of the king, the pharaoh, and all that, clearly they have an idea of an afterlife. Isis, for example, this god of the, sort of invents this idea of a resurrection. The pharaoh is going to be resurrected in the next life, but only the pharaoh. And then, later generations, they layered onto that the fact that the workers who are loyal to the pharaoh, they get to be resurrected as well. And I think, Christianity, when Judaism branched off into Christianity after the death of Jesus, You know, ancient Jews did not believe you were going anywhere.
Yeah.
Just, you're just in the ground. It's just nothing. But then, you know, layered onto that later gets this idea, centuries later, adopting from other cultures that that you actually go someplace. There's a place to go to. And then, you know, more layers get added on centuries after centuries of, you know, it eventually becomes a cosmic courthouse where all moral right and wrong are settled. You know, and the Hitlers of the ancient past didn't get away with it. You know, they will be punished in hell and all that. These things are invented by people. They just made it up and added on there. So when I was researching the history of heaven, it was rather interesting. It's not like the history of cosmology where we seem to be getting closer and closer to an understanding of what's really out there and what really happened all the way back to just after the Big Bang. But that isn't like that with heaven. All you find is that different cultures have different stories, and that the stories morph over time, but they're not arcing towards some better understanding of what's really out there. No one's, you know, getting a closer, detailed description of heaven. It's only these different cultural stories. And that's fine, but in science, we want to know what's actually true, not what's metaphorically true or psychologically true.
But in this religion section, it was interesting how you write about it's intriguing. You talk about how this kind of the evolution of the idea doesn't – it's not a progression, the concept necessarily, but that the way the New Testament talks about an afterlife, it was intriguing by some of the things that Jesus was believed to have said, that the kingdom has come upon you, that the kingdom of God is within you. You write, what if Christians believe that heaven is not a place to go, but it's the here and now? This is kind of another theme in the book, and it seemed like you were seeing that in some of these quotations by Jesus.
I think so. I think what Jesus meant is like what the – because remember, Jesus was Jewish.
Yeah.
And the ancient Jews did not believe you were going to a place in the afterlife. They believed that this is it, and all the more reason you should take care of the poor and help one another now and work to make this life a better place. And so the kingdom is within you. It's not a place to go. It's here now. And it's our duty and moral obligation to help other people and to try to make the world a little bit better place. Now, I have to say I'm in the minority on this interpretation of what Jesus said, but I'm not the only one. There are biblical scholars like Bart Ehrman, for example, who is one of the great biblical scholars. He agrees with me mostly on this and that it's an evolving story, but that if you go back to the original sources, you know, Jesus has this famous line about, you know, you standing here to his disciples, you know, will not die before you see the Son of Man return. And, you know, one interpretation of this is because atheists are fond of pointing out, well, we're still waiting. in a kind of snarky way, but maybe he didn't mean that. You know, maybe he it was a way of, because he spoke in parables. You know, he didn't always say exactly what he meant. You know, he had kind of interpreted. Maybe what he meant is, I'm coming back in your mind, in your heart. That it's up to you to create this kingdom, this better world that I've described. which is an improved version of Old Testament morality for sure. New Testament morality, Jesus' morality is a big step forward from Old Testament draconian punishments. The Old Testament is pretty brutal, and the New Testament morality is much more feminized and softer and more restorative justice rather than retributive justice. So anyway, that's my interpretation of it. You know, I'll let Christian theologians hash that out, but that's what I think.
It is interesting that you mentioned, for example, how in 1999, at least in the Catholic Church, Pope John Paul said heaven and hell are not actual physical places, but they're places where you go and be in communion with or not with, if you don't get there, with God. And I'm just wondering what you're seeing in terms of the way Christians and other religions are evolving and they're thinking about what heaven might be.
Yeah, they have to evolve, because the moment you think deeply about it at all, what's described in these simple versions of this place that you go unravels pretty quickly. For example, if I'm a Christian and after I die, I'm resurrected and I'm up there with Jesus in heaven, what's up there? Is it my physical body? And some Christian sects say, yeah, it's your physical body. Okay, how old am I?
Yeah.
Well, you're 30. because that was the age Jesus was when he was crucified. Okay, I'm 30, but I'm 63 now. So what happened to the 33 years of memories? Are those gone? Because that's part of me. That's who I am. You can have all the memories. But wait, the memories of, say, when I was 30 now are different than the memories I had, say, 10 years ago of being 30 and 20 years ago of being 30, even being 31 of being 30. You know, the memories are changed and edited, and their consequences changes depending on, you know, what the effects are of the life decisions I made and so on. Okay, it's not your physical body. And by the way, I also quote humorously from Julia Sweeney's
monologue. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, so, you know, it's like she opens this monologue with the Mormon boys coming to her house in Hollywood and pitching her on the benefits of their religion, and you get to go to heaven, and the blind shall see again, and the deaf shall hear, and the crippled shall be whole again, and so on. She says, well, I had uterine cancer, so, you know, I had my uterus taken out. When I go to heaven, do I get my uterus back? Yeah, right. You can imagine these 18-year-old Mormon boys in their
Star Trek shirts. They said yes, and she was like, I don't want it back.
I don't want it back.
Yeah, yeah.
What if you had a nose job and you liked it? Do you have to have your old nose back? I mean, what are we talking about here when we're talking about the physical reconstruction of your body? And how does that happen anyway? Are the atoms of your body in the grave actually just lifted out of the grave and swept away to heaven, or is your body reconstituted with new atoms? Like it's like the Star Trek transporter. Mm-hmm. You know, when Captain Kirk gets in the transporter and then he's on the planet, what's there? Is it just a copy of him? And if it's a copy, where's the original? Or are they scrambling his atoms and then reconstituting them out of new atoms, or is it the same atoms? Anyway, it's a big philosophical mess in terms of the problem of identity. Who are you?
Yeah.
You know, you're not just your stuff, because we know that the physical body, all your cells, almost all your cells are recycled every 7 to 10 years. So you're not the same person you were a decade ago. You're all new material.
Yeah.
But you still feel like you, and your friends and family recognize you as you and treat you as you. So there's an essence of your information that is your soul, your defining selfhood. And that information is always changing, and yet there's kind of a core cluster of characteristics and ideas and thoughts and memories that is defining you. So somehow, either religion or the scientists who want to upload your mind into the cloud or whatever, they have to solve this problem of identity. What is it that's being copied and moved or copied and placed in some new medium? What is that? And I think there's some serious problems that have to be thought through here. I don't think anyone's figured it out yet.
There's a section in the book where you examine how spiritual seekers imagine, think about immortality and how they're conceiving of all of this, which leads us to Deepak Chopra, who you describe your relationship with him as being kind of on this roller coaster over the years. And I have to say, I'm kind of amazed that it seems like you're kind of good friends, despite the fact that you haven't been in the past, but it's kind of an interesting relationship.
Deepak and I have had a very volatile relationship over the decades, and really I owe it to my wife, who sort of talked me into at least trying out his worldview a little bit more, just to see what it's all about.
Yeah.
And she did it. She just wrote him and said, you know, hey, she was pregnant at the time. Is there anything in your program? He has this whole Chopra Center in Carlsbad, California, that helps pregnant women, you know? And he says, yeah, you guys should come down. And anyway, she kind of made this all happen. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to just go in with an open mind. And instead of going in to debunk him, which I've done in the past, let's just see if there's something to it, because maybe there's something to it.
Yeah.
And if there is, there could be perfectly, you know, rational, scientific, materialist explanations for why meditation works and you know, the yoga and the tea and the massages and all that stuff that they do. And I have to say, you know, you go to this 5-star resort in Carlsbad, California on the beach where it's wonderful and beautiful, and you drink tea and do yoga and meditation and you get massage. How could you not feel better?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I mean, come on.
Yeah.
If you're not feeling better after a long weekend doing that, you know, it's you. So, but deeper, you know, Deepak thinks, I mean, I call this the Eastern wisdom traditions, because it's not just Deepak, you know, Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism, you know, the whole cluster of things. It's so different from the scientific worldview that consciousness is primary. You know, the words that Deepak uses, that consciousness is the ground of all being. You can't get underneath it. It's not like boring deeper into the atom, all the way down to quarks and string theory, you're going to find consciousness. No, no. It's just everywhere. It's almost a panpsychism. It's just, you know, everything is conscious. You know, the pen, the table, this microphone I'm staring at. You know, it's at a lower level of consciousness than the rat, than the dog, than the human. But it's everything is consciousness. And so when you die, your consciousness just returns to, you know, part of the big sea of consciousness that's everywhere. And, you know, theirs is kind of a recycling version of the afterlife in that sense. You know, in the same way that I say, you know, where people ask me, where do you think you go after you die? And I say the same place I was before I was born, which gets some looks like, well, but I wasn't anywhere before I was born. That's right. You didn't exist and you won't exist after. To Deepak in the Western Buddhist or the Buddhist tradition, you do go where you were before you were born, because you were just instantiated in this physical body as just a temporary, you know, staging for consciousness in a physical realm for a few decades. But after that, you know, eternity is real, and we continue to exist in this conscious state. That's what they think.
What does neuroscience say to that?
Neuroscientists tell us that every thought we have is generated by the physical brain. That is, we know for sure that neurons firing is what produces thoughts. And without the neurons firing, there are no thoughts. There's no function there. The mind is just a word we use to describe the brain. So, for example, if there's a stroke or injury or damage to a part of the brain, then whatever it was doing is gone. It's gone forever unless you rewire it through therapy. Or Alzheimer's with, you know, the neurons are just dying. The brain is shrinking. And along with it, memories are disappearing and the personality is disappearing and so on. That's the reality that neuroscientists tell us. Now, Deepak doesn't deny that. He says, yes, you need a brain for consciousness to be instantiated in the physical realm, much like you need a television set to pick up the signals coming in or a radio set to pick up the radio signals, which you can't see. But to that I say, yeah, but we can go to the studios. I'm in a studio right now, and you know we're broadcasting. You're broadcasting. We know where the broadcast happened. What's the equivalent of that for consciousness in the universe? Where's the consciousness broadcaster station? You know, and there is no such place. So I think the analogy only takes us so far, and after that, it breaks down. So, what we know for sure is that that mind is brain, and without it, there is no mind. And if that's not true, then the onus is on the believers in this to show us where consciousness exists, because there's not a lot of evidence for that without mind.
So, let's talk about near-death experiences. This is really interesting. There's this book back in 1975. People may remember it. It was a huge sensation, Life After Life by Raymond Moody. And it seems like this really caught hold, this idea of near-death experiences. And you know, there were stories about them and articles about all of this stuff. What do you make of this, of this moment?
Well, the experiences people have are real. The question is, what do they represent? Something that's in the head or out in the world. And so my conclusion and that of most neuroscientists is that near-death experiences are entirely in the head. We can replicate most of the components of near-death experiences in the lab. You can do it in a centrifuge. This is research by an Air Force researcher named James Winner. He's a physician, where he accelerates these pilots until they black out. It's part of their training. And but most of them have some kind of weird out-of-body experiences or whatever. And we know this is just oxygen deprivation to the cortex. The brain is just shutting down as the blood gets shunted to the center of the brain, as it does with the rest of the body. And you can do it through brain stimulation. These are open brain surgeries, usually for epileptic patients, and you get permission to wake them up during the surgery, and then they tap around in the brain with an electrode and just ask them while they're lying there awake, what are you experiencing now? This is one way to map the brain. And so there's an area in the fusiform gyro, there's an area in the temporal lobe just above your ears where if they tap it, the patient lying on the gurney says, "Whoa, I'm floating above the bed now. I'm up by the ceiling." Wow. And that's just a little cluster of neurons that are being stimulated to fire. And then there's other components that of it that we know we can replicate under other conditions. And so we think what it is just a trip. It's just kind of a wild trip stimulated by the probably the stress of near death. It's good to remember that near death experiences are near death. The person's not actually dead. Yeah. I mean, people will just say something like, I died, went to heaven and came back. No, you didn't die. And no physician would say that you were dead. You were near death. You were oxygen deprived. Your heart was stopping. Your brain was shutting down. But you weren't actually dead. And that tells us a lot. And so I cite in there Oliver Sacks' research on this because he was a great neurologist that described all the weird experiences. Every chapter in every one of his books was a kind of a weird neurological anomaly that had just people, you know, the guy who mistook his wife for a hat. I mean, what? How is this possible? And I talk about his own – I quote from his own acid trips he took in the 60s when that was a thing. And to me, they're indistinguishable from the narratives that people who describe going to heaven and coming back are like Eben Alexander's story of going to heaven in his book Proof of Heaven. You know, he was in a coma, an artificially induced coma from a virus that caused his brain to swell. And, you know, so he had this fantastic trip. The colors were vibrant, the sounds, and the people were beautiful there, and it was just incredible sense of love. And so I quote from Sam Harris's book Waking Up, in which he talks about taking ecstasy with his buddy on the couch when he's 20, and all of a sudden, you know, just incredible intense love for my friend and colors and the vibrant and the it's just, to me, they all sound the same. And you can find that in many descriptions like that in many different kinds of acid trips and artificially induced experiences. So we know for sure those are neurological. It's the brain operating there. So the chances of it also being that you actually go to a place, and by the way, the places are always different. You know, different NDE experiencers have different descriptions of what heaven is like. That tells us that it's personalized. It's in your head. Now, you know, maybe this is what heaven is really like if you actually go to a place called heaven. It isn't a place that's we could all describe in a similar way, but instead it's just in your head. Okay, but how is that distinguishable from it just being in your head, in your brain, just your neurons firing? Anyway, so that I find the whole subject terribly interesting. I mean, the fact that people can have these experiences is remarkable, but no less remarkable than all the other weird things that people can experience.
Let's talk about reincarnation, which you just basically see as kind of a function of self-transformation, I think, is how you describe it. It's like the self-transformation myth, the idea of reincarnation. How do you explain it? How do you understand it?
Yeah, so first, you know, the second line of evidence for an afterlife is reincarnation. That is, our souls continue on in the kind of traditional religious sense, but instead of going to heaven or some quantum field or something, they go back into somebody else's body, or you're really unlucky, into a cow. So right off the bat, we know that if this is true, souls seem to hover around the subcontinent of India mostly. And that alone tells us that, you know, it's a geographically determined – it's a cultural construction. It's, you know, it's made up by one particular religion primarily. And then there's the problem of population. You know, 100 billion people have lived before us, 7.5 billion people alive today. First of all, if the 7.5 billion have souls from people who previously lived, where's their soul? You know, are we talking about bodies that have more than one soul, multiple souls, like multiple personality, which we all also know is a myth? This would get pretty crowded. That would be about 14.5 souls for every person alive today crammed in there. And how is the soul stored in the neurons anyway? I mean, we know how neurons work. Where's the soul part supposed to come in? How does the soul influence at the molecular level, the neurotransmitter substances going across the synaptic gaps between neurons? To get technical, you know, we know how neurons work. How is it that the soul is supposed to do this? And, you know, none of it makes any sense logically or scientifically. But then the stories come pouring in. Oh, you know, this little boy had these memories, the one I write about, of being a World War II pilot when he was young, and he had these dreams, and the plane was on fire, and he died. And then they find some kind of match, loosely a match of somebody who actually died in World War II in a plane that was burning. Okay, that's not hard to find. This happened to a lot of people. And the idea that a little boy would be fascinated by World War II airplanes. Well, come on, I was. I built all those World War II airplanes as little models. And my father was in the Pacific War, and I used to ask him all the time to tell me stories about it. I can't get it. You know, little boys love war stories and airplanes and tanks and stuff like that. So I tracked down the details on that particular one. This was a famous story. It was a book, and he was on, his parents were on Larry King Live that I was on with. And, you know, so I got to see the whole thing unfold. And, of course, now he has no memory of any of this at this point in time. So that tells us something, that, you know, this is concocted by the caretakers and parents of these little children. And anyway, the whole thing unravels from a scientific perspective. Reincarnation is also not a stairway to heaven.
How easy is it to pull off a psychic reading?
Yeah, this idea that I've written about this in my other books and in Skeptic Magazine, that, you know, you could talk to the dead. Well, okay, first of all, anybody can talk to the dead. People talk to the dead all the time. They go to the cemetery and on the anniversary of their loved one's death, they sit there at the grave and talk to them. Okay, we're not talking about that. We're talking about the dead talking back. What? Yeah, there are people that claim they can hear the voices of dead people. Okay, you know, I see dead people, I hear dead people. Okay, these psychic mediums claim to do this, and it's a scam. It's a con. It's now, maybe not intentionally. Maybe they actually think they're hearing voices. Who knows? But they aren't, for sure. And we know how to do it. It's a cold reading where you read somebody cold you never met, and there's techniques I describe in the book about how to do it. You can do it. It's not that hard. I've done it many times myself. You know, there's kind of a set of things you can say, like someone who's lost someone, a man who has lost a father, a grandfather, uncle, will typically keep the watch. I did when my dad died. I kept his watch. I have no idea why I did this. I just immediately wanted his watch. And it turns out that they say this for almost all guys. Well, it turns out most men keep the watch of their father or grandfather. And women keep jewelry, and everybody keeps keepsakes like photographs. And so you can say, I'm getting something about a watch. He's telling me you have his watch. And the guy will be sitting there going, oh my God, it's incredible. I have my dad's watch. How did he know? Because everybody does it. Right. Okay, so I could spend 15 minutes telling you how to do psychic readings, you know. But in short, there's, you know, a couple hundred things that are true for most people, and if you know, you only need a few dozen memorized, and you throw these things out, you'll get hits, enough hits that people will think that you've actually made contact with the dead. Even specific things like something about a scar on your knee, the number 2 in your address, you know, a post-it note on the refrigerator, an out-of-date calendar, you know, a power tool that's broken you've been hanging on to, a missing earring. You know, there's books about how to do this where they list all these things. And the person that taught me worked for the Psychic Friends Network back in the 90s. And he said they gave him a 3-ring notebook, you know, here's a couple hundred things you can say when you're on the phone with these people that are grieving to keep them on the phone at $3.95 a minute. You know, it's a scam. Yeah. But people think that it's real because, you know, they remember the hits, they forget the misses, they have no idea that this is true for most people. And anyway, so it's not a conduit to the other side, unfortunately.
I want to come back around to there's this story that you I have to say it's a crazy story of this was a few years ago, and there was this old radio in a desk drawer that so it had been your fiance's grandfather's who had died some years before. This is the day you're getting married. Your fiance had been sort of pining for her family back in Germany. She'd been feeling particularly homesick, and the radio just starts to play. Not only that, it plays a love song at first. It plays for the rest of your wedding day. And then it stops and you're never able to get it fixed again to work again. Now, so that's an amazing story. So I just wanted to talk about the reaction you got because you wrote about this and the explanations you got and ultimately what you take from that, because it seems like something happened.
Yeah, so I wrote about the story initially in Scientific American, and I got so much mail from this, mostly from people who had similar experiences, not with radios, but just unusual things that happened in their lives that connected them to people that they had a loving relationship with. And so I thought, well, this is pretty interesting. I mean, these anomalous psychological experiences, I could concoct explanations, you know, law of large numbers and randomness, statistical improbabilities happen, every day, when you have enough people doing these things and so on. I mean, that's kind of what I do in my column in general. But in this case, you know, it was the timing of it and the emotional salience for my wife that this was a transistor radio. She was raised by a single mom and her grandfather, and they used to listen to the radio together, and it didn't work. And she shipped it to me. I tried to get it to work. It didn't work. I mean, it was really spooky the way it happened. It just came on at the very moment she was feeling super blue about not having any family or friends at our wedding in California. She's from Cologne, Germany. And, so we took a quiet moment in the back of the house and heard this music playing, and I'm thinking, this is weird. I don't have a stereo system in my house. Maybe it's my iPhone. Maybe it's my laptop. No, maybe it's the scanner. Maybe they put radios in these scanners. No, it's not that. It's the radio, perfectly tuned. It could have been tuned in between stations with static or, some funky country, western, or rock. No, and it was this classical station playing this beautiful music and so on. And just the timing, and all that, the connectedness. Now, I can't conclude that, my wife's grandfather's in some other dimension, reaching through our dimension to stir the particles inside the radio. I'm not going to conclude that. I don't know what the explanation is. But in a sense, you don't have to have an explanation. Science can't explain everything. It's okay to embrace the mystery, particularly when it has emotional significance for you. And just know that, somehow love brings us all together. Now, Deepak thinks that that's absolutely true in terms of connecting conscious states, that love is the connecting element there. Okay, maybe. I mean, that would be nice if that was true. I don't know. And I'm willing to just say the story happened and acknowledge that it happens to a lot of people and that it's okay to just say, I don't know, but it was a connection for us that was meaningful, and leave it at that.
Well, that seems to be where you finally come down, and I guess I'll ask you finally, is what you say in the book is that you're hoping that people will just revel in the mystery and be willing to say, I don't know.
Yeah, I think in both cases, both with believers and with atheists, each side wants to have final answers. And, the fact is we don't have final answers. A purely rational scientific worldview must embrace the mystery, must say, we don't know everything. I don't know for sure. There's no afterlife. And that's why at the end of the book I say, it doesn't really matter whether there's an afterlife or not, because we don't live in the afterlife. We live in this life now, not in the hereafter, here. Now. So, make it count, make every day count, regardless of what happens after. We don't know what happens after. So just make sure that every day, every relationship, every loving connection you have to another human being it counts, and you make it count every day.
It's Michael Shermer. His book is Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia. Joined us from the studios at UC Santa Barbara. Michael, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Thanks to Claire Jones, the program directed by Tim Slover, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.